This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Today we're talking about the most powerful music in the world, the protest songs of the Civil Rights Movement. These are the songs that fought hate and beat an entrenched system of racial oppression.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome.
Since I went down to register, there's been bloodhounds in front of my door. We being harassed, and whether I work at home or wash, the bills go high and high. Everything to put me out of Ruval is being done, but I'll be right there fighting for freedom until God say enough done.
We worked all of March, and as was to be expected, there was more violence. Sam Block and Willie Peacock were shot at in front of the office one night as they were parked. And then finally, late in March, one of our workers, George Green, was shot at just as he entered his house, having returned home late at night from work in the office. That next morning, we gathered on the church steps at Wesley Methodist Church in Greenwood and started singing.
Get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, let's fight for human rights. We know as freedom fighters that we may go to jail, but when you fight for freedom, the Lord will go your bail. Get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, let's fight for human rights.
And we sang and we sang and we sang, and people gathered around, and finally we sang We Shall Overcome in a big circle, and I talked to them and explained to them why I thought we needed to walk downtown. We never got to the courthouse. We were met at the police station with police dogs. They told us to turn around or the dog would be turned loose on them.
I never thought that Greenwood peoples would treat Negroes that been around here, that nursed their children and cooked for them and farmed this land, that they would have those type of police that would put dogs on human. I was knocked off my feet the other day. I saw a terrible thing happen. I saw him put a dog on a first-class citizen, decent man, and told him he was a black son of a bitch. Kennedy is your God. I never will overcome it. A black son of a bitch. A man is not a son of a bitch. A man is a created being made in God's image. And when God made man, he said he was good.
Here's a freedom song for all your freedom fighters out there everywhere. And when you sing, remember the wonderful ones who lost their dedicated lives for this precious purpose and won't be around to see it through. Now sing, sing, every one of you.
Well, sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world?
Sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world? Freedom in the world.
Tell me where.
Where is freedom?
Tell me where.
Where is freedom?
Tell me
where. Where is freedom?
I wanna know. Well, trouble in Atlanta.
Where is freedom?
And in Tennessee.
Where is freedom?
Courts in Alabama.
Where is freedom?
Walk to be free.
Where is freedom?
March in Savannah.
Where is freedom?
And in Baltimore.
Where is freedom?
Kneel and lose.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the most powerful music in the world, the protest songs of the civil rights era. We get an idea of what some of that music sounded like with the civil rights movement. We're going to hear more this afternoon. First, our guest, Robert Darden, is a professor of journalism and the founder of the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University, the author of many books, including the two-volume Nothing But Love in God's Water, which tackles this very interesting topic. Also with us is Dr. Kimberlyn Munford. She is a professor of music history and the co-director of African American Studies at Trinity University. And we want to hear from the community. If you were part of the movement, what did the music mean to you? What role did you think that it played? How significant was it? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. And Robert Darden, welcome back to The Source. It's great to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
So talk about, please, when Dr. Martin Luther King is talking about the We Shall Overcome, what did that song mean to him?
There's a wonderful story about when King hears it the first time. He's coming back from the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, and he has just heard it from Pete Seeger and Guy Carawan and others who have collected it from the tobacco workers in Carolina and other places. And he's driving back with several people, and the story goes that he touches the driver and says, "You know that We Shall Overcome song? Man, that really sticks with you." And in fact, it did. And he sang it. There's not many records that he sang it in Montgomery, but every action site from Albany onward, it's sung, and it becomes the anthem of the movement. It's most often sung at the end of any kind of meeting, whether it's a mass rally or a funeral, with the arms crossed, with different people taking the lead after each verse. And it becomes ingrained into the DNA of the movement and remains there still.
Kimberlyn Munford, not just the movement, but it's global.
Mm-hmm, indeed. It's a song, first of all, it caught the human imagination because of the association with civil rights. But then just the sound of it, it's actually a pretty simple song. And so it's simple to harmonize with and simple to improvise on. And so many of the people, as they're singing this, they're kind of personalizing it.
And Pete Seeger, let's hear him. This is from his album from Carnegie Hall, 1963.
If you would like to get out of a pessimistic mood yourself, I got one sure remedy for you. Go help those people down in Birmingham and Mississippi or Alabama. All kinds of jobs that need to be done. It takes hands and hearts and heads to do it, human beings to do it. And then we'll see this song come true. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. For deep in my heart, I know that I do believe. Oh, we shall overcome some. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand.
Oh, freedom. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave.
Oh, yeah.
And go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord.
That's Harry Belafonte singing "O Freedom," 1960 is that recording, and we're talking about the songs of the Civil Rights Movement, and this is one of them, a pillar of that movement, recorded by many, a very emotional song. And Robert Darden is with us, professor of journalism, founder of the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project. He's written about this over at Baylor University, and also with us is Kimberlyn Monford, professor of music history, co-director of the African American Studies at Trinity University. Kimberlyn, that song, what is its significance?
So there's a couple of things. First of all, it's based on an older spiritual, and it has that connection with slavery and thus, you know, any sort of oppression. But the later versions, the gospel versions, tend to accentuate more this idea of communal oppression, communal suffering, and communal transcendence, communal the ability to overcome that, and the idea that you're not going to participate in the system. You're not going to participate in the system of slavery or participate in the system that doesn't allow people to have basic human rights. So there's that connection there, as well as the fact, again, you know, a lot of this music is just so powerful, and for a lot of people in the African American community, they have long-standing connections of hearing their grandparents singing it, seeing great-grandparents singing it. So it's not only talking about the situations that they're finding themselves in that day or that period of time, but it harkens back to older problems and older means of kind of negotiating those difficulties.
And Robert Darden, where would the movement been without the utilization of this type of music?
I asked Representative John Lewis that very question when I was interviewing for the book. And he, of course, his voice is about four octaves lower than God. So it just chilled me hearing it. And what he said, young man, black sacred music provided the wings that allowed the civil rights movement to soar. It seems as I got deeper into the research, that particular sentiment was that there were people who had been at some of the most historic marches in some of the most dangerous places on the earth and heard from some of the greatest speakers. And 60 years later, they couldn't really tell me what was said. They didn't know what law was passed when and who was where. But they could sing these songs to me and tell me what they were doing and what they meant at every single movement event they were at. Mm-hmm. And it seemed that from that this music had been incorporated into their being, and that they needed it. It was more than just a luxury or a way to release steam, that it was something that was necessary. And I spent a lot of time in interviews trying to quantify that in a way that other academics would understand. And it's certainly a spiritual connection.
It was a spiritual connection, but it was also laid the foundation for organization.
Well, absolutely. When you come from, as many of them did, the black church, which for centuries had been the one refuge and the one place of organization in the black community and the only safe place that they could go, that's a singing church. And most services can sense a whole lot more singing than they did preaching or testifying. And the organization that came and the immediate ability to work and know the body of music that was there, the right song at the right time, the ability to assign instinctively parts, inherent rhythm and such, is part of something that I'm not sure could be duplicated anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. And you want to add to that?
Yeah. There's also the fact that by just getting together and singing at the same time, they're forging these connections, these immediate connections. And these could be people from different parts of the city or different parts of the state or different parts of the country. But when they get together and they're starting to sing these songs that all of them have these connections to and they're harmonizing with it, they're creating this a new community for that very event. And they're developing these bonds and forging and cementing creating a foundation for the work that they're going to be doing that time.
Mm-hmm. So work songs is also part of this, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. That this is as old as, you know, the situation that mm-hmm. we've had mm-hmm. here in the African-American slave trade. This I'm going to play a piece. This is from John Lomax. This is a recording mm-hmm. of Rock Island Line.
I said the Rock Island Line is the mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Well, Jesus died to save me and all of my sin. Oh, while it's glory to God, we're gonna meet him again. I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a road to ride.
I said the Rock Island Line
is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
That song, the way it's composed and the way it's delivered, it has that driving beat. It sounds fresh today as it was when this was recorded, which was, I don't know, 70 years ago, Robert Darden?
Well, the fun thing is the distinctives of African music, what was brought mm-hmm. over in the 1600s, 1800s from Western Africa, those distinctives, the emphasis on the beat, the flatted thirds and sevenths, the call and response, the improvisation, that's the root of all American popular music, with a possible exception of country and Western. Everything comes from that basic root that you could hear in those early work songs and early spirituals. And I might add that most of the work songs were also spirituals. Mm-hmm. You look at songs like Michael Rowe, Your Boat Ashore, a very, very early work song. The next line is Hallelujah. There was not the original African singers didn't differentiate between the sacred and the profane. Mm-hmm. Both kinds of songs had elements of each.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, the important element of most African music, and with a few notable exceptions in African American music, is this sense of the music coming out of the community. And there's no idea that we have the strongest voice or the best voice. It's whoever is taking the lead at that time who might sing the call, and then the group will sing the response. But everyone participates, and everyone is a part of the musical experience. Again, that I think the communality that we see is kind of invoked in the civil rights that is a part of this type of music for centuries.
Right, and Robert Darden, you write about that in your book. You say that this was a rehearsal of the collective for action.
Hmm. Absolutely. It's a almost apostolic continuum in my mind. This goes from the earliest protest spirituals right through today. It permeates so much of what has happened because this is an ongoing civil rights struggle. There never was an end to it.
The record that we have of this music, I mean, a lot of it was trapped in the moment and not really
right.
captured.
Well, that's frustrating because the Folkways Records, which has virtually all that we have of it, somebody had the idea to stick a little handheld microphone on a pew and record some of these explosive movements of 1,000 people in Birmingham and Selma, Memphis, and that's really much all we have. But that's not a whole lot different than the spirituals. All we have are the spirituals or snapshots of what they sounded like one night on one plantation as transcribed by a white transcriber who had been trained in Western music pentatonic scale. We have about 6,000 known spirituals of the what we believe is many, many times more than that. And the same with the freedom songs. We just have a snapshot of what they sounded like on one night in different places. There were many, many more. And as we traveled and interviewed people who were a part of it, they would almost all of them would sing us something we had never heard before. Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes this so interesting, Kimberlyn Munford, mm-hmm. is that there is this giant body out there, but it's constantly changing and impossible really to pin down on where it came from.
Well, so first of all, the tradition is that of being expressive of what's going on at that moment in time. So even if you had the same singer singing the same song two nights in a row, in most cases you will not hear the exact same performance. That's just a part, that's a convention of African-American music, particularly of gospel music, is that you personalize it as you sing it. So it's going to be difficult to capture that anyway. And in fact, that is some of the beauty of it, is that you never hear it the same way at the same time. It's difficult for us as historians because we wanna get all of these things saved and archived, et cetera. But that's one of the aspects of the music that you kind of have to take into consideration, that there's always going to be, Thelonious Monk's version of this and someone else's version of that. And even their versions are going to change from time to time. But that's kind of one of the hallmarks of the music. That's one of the aspects of African music that is still retained.
So back to the protest music. I'm going to play this. This is Wallace, and I think and it is kind of, and it has more of sort of a popular pop music sort of a root to it, not necessarily straight out of the spiritual. Mm-hmm. It shows you how a how morphine this type of music is. And Robert Darden, that was taken right out of the actual protest.
Mm-hmm. One of the fun things was I lined up all of the Folkways Records versions of We Shall Overcome, from the very earliest ones to the ones following Resurrection City. And you can hear, as Dr. Mumford said, the evolution as Stax and Volt and Motown start entering, and it goes from very magisterial and folky to this wonderful, surging, moving with counterbeats and hand claps that have been set up. It's a different song almost together from a musical standpoint, and the force just keeps building and building because black music doesn't stay the same.
So when you had a protest, when did the music come in? How was that incorporated, Kimberlyn?
So there's a couple of different ways. First of all, pretty early on they might have, hymns or something like that. But one of the major aspects of it is when there's actual movement or marching. So you have to recognize that these, in many cases, the idea behind this is nonviolent. So you're not reacting to people throwing things in your face or yelling at you or whatever. And so something has to move. Some sort of expression has to take place, some sort of way of letting these feelings out. And when you're marching and singing at the same time, you're reinforcing, first of all, the community. You're actively doing something that is expressing how you're feeling about the situation. You're creating this wall of sound that is protecting you from what's going on around you. And you're also creating this wall of sound that's kind of coming down the street, bombarding whoever's in your way. So in the act of the actual marching or the actual sit-ins or the stand-ins in some cases, the music is a major part of that.
And talk about that, Richard Darden, Robert Darden.
Absolutely. Nothing much to add. I mentioned in the beginning, it's in the DNA, and the things happen with the Black Lives Matter, and you would see a crowd of mostly young people, 18 to 20, surging down the street, and all of a sudden, out of their collective throats would come one of these songs. They had been there all that time waiting for this moment.
Right, and so I've been to some protests where there's not music, and it just seems sort of like chaos. Mm-hmm. And by having people singing songs and being able to unite, and it does sort of give it an idea that there is a collective energy focused at one particular place. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about civil rights movement and the music that gave that movement its beat and its tone, its timbre. We're joined by Robert Darden, a professor of journalism and the founder of the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University, author of many books, including two volumes, Nothing But Love in God's Water, which looks at the sacred music that was in the sit-ins to Resurrection City and all through the civil rights movement. Also with us is Kimberlyn Monford, professor of music history and co-director of African American Studies at Trinity University. We're going to hear, this is Mahala Jackson, Duke Ellington playing Keep Your Hand on the Plow.
Shout, be
This is 1958 at Jazz Festival, in Newport Jazz Festival, and this is right after the Montgomery bus boycott, and so this was a right was as things were starting to gel and things were coming together. And why is this song significant, Kimberlyn?
Okay, so first of all, it's based on a spiritual. So, you know, you have this idea of this music that comes from the black community, and it's performed by a woman who's used to singing gospel, but she's in this jazz situation in which you often hear people who are expressing themselves. Their music is kind of based on the eye, and it's their experience. But what makes it so fascinating is that this music is that of the collective, and by her singing it in this context, it's obviously showing this connection, this solidarity with the cause, but it's kind of taking her ability and her platform and her audience and sharing this information as well, and kind of inviting them to be a part of this collective, a part of this community.
And Robert Darden?
Yeah, there's a fascinating documentary based on her performances at Newport. But one of the things that I'd like to mention is that while the standard histories of the civil rights movement mention Mahalia Jackson from time to time, I don't think until just recently we're discovering what a significant impact she had. She was one of the largest donors to so many of the causes. They wouldn't have got hundreds of people out of jail without the money she gave and Harry Belafonte and a few, very few others. And then at several times during the movement, when things really looked bad, she shows up sometimes almost unannounced in Montgomery and does a concert, or in Chicago after that terrible event where they're all beaten in Cicero and all their cars are destroyed and they make their way back to the church. She's waiting for them in the basement and sings them spirituals and freedom songs until they're ready to go home. She knew it.
So I want to bring these songs into the present. They are still very much very important to us. This is a version of that song, Keep Your Hand on the Plow, also known as Eyes on the Prize. This is Bruce Springsteen.
The only chain that a man can stand is the chain of hand to hand. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. I'm gonna board that big greyhound, carry my love from town to town. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
That's The Boss doing Eyes on the Prize, his version live in Milwaukee in 2006. So, Robert Darden, can you talk about the future of this music? Where is it going?
Well, I had thought when I'd finished Volume 2 with Resurrection City and The Death of King and things, that was the end, and it was kind of a downer. But it was my son, I think, that mentioned to me, Dad, you know, they sang We Shall Overcome at the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I got interested and started doing research and found out that these songs were sung at Tiananmen Square. They were sung in a host of other movement sites around the world by people who weren't black, who weren't Christian. They were sung in multiple sites. If you watched the BBC coverage at the Arab Spring, I heard people sung in Libya and Lebanon and Morocco. And they're being sung now at the Black Lives Matter. These songs are still there.
And John Lewis sang it when they were sitting on the floor of the House trying to get a vote on gun legislation.
And it worked.
Well,
people
heard it, but they never got the vote. and can you talk about Kimberlyn Monford, about how you see the music is relevant to today?
So first of all, in the case of Bruce Springsteen, he's just known for being able to tap into just the tenor of the day and capture various aspects of life of everyday people, not just musicians, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a beautiful version, first of all, of that song, and I love hearing him do that. But this is one of those things where, as I say, for the African American community, they have these ties and these associations with these songs, and many of the people who originally sang this had no idea how powerfully it would affect not only the people that they're singing kind of against, if you want to put it that way, but also the people who are not in Birmingham, not in Montgomery, but are watching this on TV or hearing it on the radio, and then it's broadcast across, on the BBC and things like that. And so they have no idea how other people are making these connections with their struggles. And so I had no idea that this had been sung during some of the Arab Spring protests, but I'm going to go back and listen for that. But I can see how it would be really powerful and how they would connect with that, having no idea sometimes even what the language is, or even, you know, maybe the musical connection or even the religion, but just that powerful idea, the impact of the ideas and the notions.
So, and Robert Darden, you write a lot about how this music was originally has roots in a black sacred music tradition, but also a lot of the protest music comes from American labor efforts, wobblies, mm-hmm. Yep. And so on. Let's hear Which Side You're On by the Freedom Singers. Robert Darden?
That one, and my favorite one is We Shall Not Be Moved, which came out of the rigid, out of the labor movement. When unions finally allow African Americans to join, particularly some of those in New York and elsewhere, the two traditions, the 200-year tradition of labor song and the civil rights, the music coming from the Civil War and the spirituals, they create something new altogether. And they pick up from each other. And as you know, many of King's earliest advisors came from the labor movement, and they bring. Mm-hmm. Bernard Rustin was a singer of spirituals who had been trained in labor technique. And couple that with the singing of the African-American church, you create an irresistible force.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who like to eliminate the history of labor in the movement. King was assassinated when he was in Memphis trying to deal with a labor strike,
right,
with the garbage collectors there. Mm-hmm. And Billy Bragg, he plays this song nowadays, and he is known as a pro-labor guy. He's British, and this is his version.
We set off to join the picket lines, but together we cannot fail. We got stamped by police at the county line. They said, go on, boys, or you'll go into jail. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Very different take on Which Side Are You On? And Robert Darden, that is not in your book.
No, but Billy Bragg is the modern Pete Seeger. He is one of my all-time favorite artists. He's been on the right side of every issue for decades.
And so do you think that we're going to be seeing a resurgence of the songs? We're seeing protests now crystallizing across the country, and people, you know, they will be digging into this songbook.
Well, I certainly heard them in Orlando. I heard them again in Charlotte. I heard them in Ferguson. Nothing seems to have changed in that regard.
Right, but it's the importance of people knowing where these references come from and knowing the history of all of these things, Kimberlyn Monford.
Mm-hmm. So, so a couple of things. First, I don't know how many young people may know a lot of the history. They know they've heard it. They may, as babies or whatever, they've heard some of this music at their parents' knee, and so they have those connections. What I find fascinating is that they're changing this music because this is a living tradition. They're changing this music. They're pulling in pop music. They're pulling in soul. They're pulling in some funk stuff, and they're using that music as well and kind of combining them in maybe slightly unusual ways. But again, it's a living tradition. So while the actual songs, some may fall away, some may be retained, they're going to change and they're going to continue to grow and they're going to continue to evolve. And probably some of the original singers may not recognize them, but they definitely groove to them and they definitely be able to, it would resonate for them.
Our phone lines are open. If you want to join our conversation as we talk about protest music from the civil rights to today, give us a call. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. When we come back, we're going to pick up on what you just said there, Kimberly. We're going to hear some Public Enemy picking up some of this tradition as well, moving into the future, into the present. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay tuned.
So feed the people, help the homeless, underfed. Revolution, stop the feds, leaving people left for dead. We should groove, check your heads. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
I Shall Not Be Moved. That is a song with a long tale through history. Mm-hmm. And that's from Public Enemy, 2012. And now this is the Freedom Singers doing their version of it. And now here's another version. This is from Blind Roosevelt Graves and his brother, I Shall Not Be Moved, 1929.
I shall not be moved just like a tree that's planted by the water. I shall not be moved. I'm on my way to heaven, I shall not be moved. I'm on my way to heaven.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the civil rights music, protest songs from the past and from the present. We're speaking with Robert Darden, a professor of journalism, a founder of the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University, author of many books, including two volumes of Nothing But Love and God's Water, and Kimberlyn Monford, professor of music history and co-director of African American Studies at Trinity University. Quite a panel. Panorama there, Kimberlyn.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And perhaps Professor Darden could talk more about the history of this, but my understanding is that this is one of those pieces that it has its connection with spirituals and kind of went through a little bit, like the version that we heard now, kind of a Dixieland kind of version of that. But we also hear a version of it, and I don't think it was Thomas Dorsey, but it was one of the early gospel solo singers, and there may be actual, I'm sure there's a recording of it somewhere, singing this, but it's one of those where it initially was voicing this collective idea that no matter what was going on, you'd still be strong, you'd still be powerful, you know, people would die, you'd lose this, different things would happen, but you'd still stay powerful, and it was sung by the community, it was sung by the group, and then it kind of went through this phase where you hear someone singing it like, I shall not be moved, and making it really, really personal. And then when it was taken over again by the civil rights movement, by the freedom singers, they're singing this again in this collective where they're supporting each other and the strength of the of their ability to not be moved, their strength of their ability to not be overcome is because of their collective movement, their collective work, and their collective efforts. So then the Public Enemy version is fabulous because he's saying, no, I shall not be moved. He's taking it really, really as an affirmation of his own personal strength.
Right, and when you listen to the entire song, you hear him talking about a number of issues of social justice. Mm-hmm. Robert Darden, that song, the history?
Well, the first recorded, I mean, the record of somebody singing it was the great coal miner songwriter Aunt Molly Jackson.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so she may have, because she was certainly in close contact with the African American group. People don't realize how many black miners there were. And she may have indeed picked up part of that from a spiritual. But do you, when you hear a song like that, or We Shall Overcome, or Hold On, or any of the others still sung today, not that dissimilar from where they were sung in the 1920s, you realize these songs have been honed through the fire and through the blood of martyrs and then attacked from all sides and used, that they survived because all that remains are the words and the basic melody line. Everything else has been stripped away. They survive because they work.
Some people died with these songs on their lips.
Absolutely. The Wobblies died by the hundreds singing these songs.
And also the civil rights workers in the South. You know, bombings and other attacks. There are civil rights songs, were they ever recorded in studios and you know, got airplay, Robert Darden?
The two Freedom Singer discs actually were released on a major label, and they got some airplay. They were, of course, sent back from the South with all of the covers defaced from record state labels down there. There was some, not as much as you would have hoped from the rock and pop and soul community, but these songs continued to be played, whether or not they were radio hits, and whether it's Lauryn Hill today or Tom Morello, they just continue that tradition. It doesn't have to be a hit to be impactful.
But like Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, that became a hit for a number of groups. But that song has its roots also in African-American songs, as in it is directly comes from the No More Auction Block for Me.
That's right. Same chord progression. Absolutely.
It did sort of, this music migrated in its own way to pop culture.
It's pretty pervasive. And I agree with Dr. Mumford that it doesn't have to be spelled out to kids. Now, I was at a MLK observance on Monday, and they closed with singing it, and I paid particular attention to the young kids, black and white, around me, junior high, high school. They jumped right in. They didn't need any prompting.
It's interesting when you talked earlier about how kids and their ability and their knowledge base, that I've noticed from my own daughter, is that there are some things that she has incredible depth of knowledge about, because the way that they observe the world is differently. And they say, oh, they get interested in something, and then they will start Googling and figuring things out and researching and looking on YouTube and everything on their own. And suddenly they'll figure this stuff out on their own and have an incredible depth of knowledge. So all that's out there waiting for them to pick up.
Definitely. And there's a collective unconscious about this. This music is in the air. This music is in their ears. You know, they may not necessarily pay attention. They may not be hits. No one may bring their attention to it. But you'd be surprised if I could sing probably a half a dozen gospel tunes that you may have never heard or thought you heard, and you could probably sing along because the music is out there, and it's you know, sometimes it's kind of subversive. It's heard in the background of another song or in a hip hop tune. They'll pull in a little sample of it or whatever. But the music is out there, and I like to think that some of the notions behind it are also out there.
And Robert Darden, you said that you've written that a lot of these songs were on the B side of 45s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a fun thing. As we put this project together, we had no idea. In fact, nobody did. These unknown artists would do the pop song on the A side, hoping it would have radio play. But
that's
on the
right.
B side, throughout the 60s, they would write very aggressively pro-civil rights songs at a time. That was pretty darn dangerous. I Ain't No Segregation in Heaven is one showed up several times in a number of compositions. So in that regard, it was kind of like, to me, the double-voicedness of the old spirituals, where the overseers and owners thought they were singing about heaven, but they were really singing about freedom.
That's
getting
exactly
over the
right.
Ohio River. And here, 100 years later, these gospel songs by these tiny artists, the flip side would be just to the audience that was on the inside. I'm singing for Dr. King.
And there was practical information in these songs as well as means of how to stage a nonviolent protest and be able to stage a sit-in You're going to need bail. You're going to be deal with all that.
And Wade in the Water was originally a song to help the slaves escape the bloodhounds. Mm-hmm. And Wade in the Water, I've heard versions lately of everybody from Mavis Staples to Ashley Cleveland. And the song has got a number of instructions, kind of like Follow the Drinking Gourd.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
If you listen to enough verses, you'll have an idea of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Robert Darden, with your Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University, and you're saving this music, you're recovering it. Does that include the civil rights music as well?
Absolutely. The topic is the original mandate we had was broad enough not just to include that, which we have hundreds of different versions, as include black preaching, black preachers throughout that era. Made recordings, and sometimes the church has made recordings, and we want and keep all of those. And some of those are what we're providing to the new National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C.
All right. I want to thank both our guests. We're going to go out with Pete Seeger doing We Shall Overcome, as we started out with. And I want to thank Kimberlyn Monfort, Professor of Music History, Co-Director, African American Studies at Trinity University, and Robert Darden, Professor of Journalism and the founder of the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University. Thank you so much. It was great having you.
You bet.
Thank you.
If you would like to get out of a pessimistic mood yourself, I got one sure remedy for you. Go help those people down in Birmingham and Mississippi or Alabama. All kinds of jobs that need to be done. It takes hands and hearts and heads to do it. Human beings to do it. And then we'll see this song come true.